What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Who will be selected number one? Which teams will trade up and down? And who will be crowned Mr. Irrelevant? It's time for the 2024 NFL Draft. And iHeart is your home for the NFL Podcast Network. Get all the insights, mock drafts, and trade rumors with podcasts like Around the NFL and Move the Sticks. Open the free iHeart app and search NFL Draft for dozens of podcasts, playlists, and live stations to get you ready for the weekend's big event.
Let's go!
Listen to NFL podcasts on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search NFL to start listening.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another edition of the Playing Through podcast. You know, it's kind of crazy. We're all still stuck in our houses here, and we are in three different parts of Florida as we do this podcast. We're on Instagram at Playing Through podcast. You can get us, yes. Wacker is in Miami. He's a Canes fan. We're going to forgive him for that. I'm a Gator fan, and our host, Paul Azinger, is a Florida State graduate. So we have got the state of Florida covered.
I didn't graduate, but I appreciate that.
Good to know. At least you went there. That's more than you've got on me going to Florida. So, and I think your wife went to Florida State, correct?
Yeah, I did. I met my wife there, actually. And yeah, we love Tallahassee. I don't go back there very often. I don't go to games very often, quite honestly. Going to a game in Gainesville actually is quite intense and actually quite a bit better. I love going there to watch football in Gainesville, even though I don't pull for the Gators.
It is rough. You can get us on Instagram, once again, at Playing Through Podcast, at BrianWacker1, and at Froggy Radio. So, Paul Azinger, thank you so much for giving us your time. And so, what have you been doing during quarantine other than just staying home?
Yeah, I think I figured out I know how to clean a little bit, finally. I mean, I started cleaning around the house and cleaning the garage up a little bit and found some things I didn't know over there that need to get tossed. But we're pretty lucky here in Florida. Brian and I talked about this before. I mean, he lives in an apartment complex. When I open my front door, I'm not in a hallway. And, you know, it's been really pretty easy for us in Florida for the most part. I think DeSantis really focused on the nursing homes and trying to keep them safe as much as anything. And he kept the golf open, which has been a real blessing for most of us that love golf. We've been able to stay outside and do that. The boat ramps got closed. That was tough. But I have a boat on a lift, so I got lucky there, too. And all in all, it hasn't been too bad, but I sure do feel for the folks that have suffered through this thing. And hopefully it can come to an end. You know, at this point in time, the bottom line is we quarantine healthy people. That's hard to do. And all of us at risk, and I'm at risk. Let's face it, I'm 60. I've had an issue before with cancer. So I imagine my immune system was compromised at some point, but I'm not going to stop. I want to go do an event as soon as possible. And you know, you just got to mind your germ intake if you're one of those people at risk, I think. And let's just try to get on with it.
Yeah, we were all there. I was there as a fan and watching. I know Wacker was working and you were working as well at TPC Sawgrass. And
yeah,
I was very surprised on that Thursday when they did have round one. And then there was the beginning of we weren't going to have fans for round two. And then that night, Thursday evening, I believe Wacker was one of the first people to break it on Twitter that we were – canceling the Players Championship. And our world changed drastically from Thursday to Sunday. Things really took a strange turn of events.
Yeah, wasn't that weird? I'll never forget that as long as I live. I don't think my kids will ever forget it. You know, the whole golf crowd really was really – we were amped up and ready to go for the Players. It looked spectacular. And what an effort was put in. All the events, really, with the – amount of infrastructure that they have to build in the Players' Championship, people there from all over the world. And I think, you know, the more you look at it, you start to realize sports was what shut down the whole world, really, the globe, because you couldn't really play sports if it was this contagious, if you could be asymptomatic and spread this virus unknowingly or unwittingly. And it just scared us all to death. I remember telling one of the young girls in the compound, I think our life's about to get interrupted in a major way. So just, you know, get ready. I didn't realize it was going to be like this, but you knew something terrible was going to happen here. And it has happened. A lot of loss of life, you know, economically, goodness. So sports wise, it looks like golf is going to try to take a swing at being the first sport back. And, you know, it'll be good for the general public, I think, to get a little sniff of normalcy if playing a skins game with four of those players is normal. So we'll see how it plays out. Rich Lerner's going to be there because Dan Hicks isn't allowed to cross state lines and come to Florida to do this event that we're going to end up doing in Jupiter. But all in all, golf's going to start back up again. But the moment it closed down at the Players was a shock to the system. And I kept looking at my wife and saying, is this real? Is this really happening? And suddenly every one of us was looking like, well, are we 2 weeks from our mortality? We didn't, nobody knows, and we still right. don't know. So we still don't know. I just don't think I want to live like that. I want to just mind my germ intake and see, you know, if we can just move on.
Right.
Yeah, Paul, you mentioned that obviously they'll start back up sort of slowly with these. We, of course, got the TaylorMade event, friend of the program of ours, of course, with Rory and Ricky and Dustin and Matt Wolf, and then of course the big match with Tiger and Phil and Brady and Manning involved as well the yeah. week after that, and then of course we get the tour, which their plans are to start June 11th at Colonial. What's I'm curious to hear your take on that from the standpoint of A, do you think they'll still be able to do that given we've heard the commissioner talk about, you know, mm-hmm. there has to be widespread testing. We haven't seen that just yet. And secondly, do you think it's a good idea to start up in mid-June at Colonial without fans?
Well, I think it's a great idea to actually try to start at some point in time. I mean, we're better off starting too early than starting too late, because if you start too late, it's too late. So you got to risk starting too early. And whether it happens or not, I believe it's going to depend on the situation in the region that the tour is going to go to first in Fort Worth, Texas. If that COVID's rising, I doubt they'll play. The idea of playing without fans, though, Brian, I think it doesn't bother me. It's kind of cool, really. Maybe they'll play without caddies a week or two. We'll find out who the slow players really are then. They'll all be identified. I think they should all go out by themselves. No caddy, and then we'll find out who the players are. Or let them take their caddy, even. We'll find out who the slow guys are then. But all in all, I mean, if there's no fans, it's still pressure. It was pressure to win a college event, so they had no fans in college. Hopefully it'll happen. I'm rooting for the tour to be able to start in June. I think it's a little optimistic, but I'm pulling for that to happen. Got to have a lot of things happen. A lot of the players are going to want to have to take the chance. Some won't be able to travel globally, just like Dan Hicks can't come to Florida. I called him today and teased him that he was banned from Florida for a while. but, yeah, hopefully everybody will be able to come to the Colonial that wants to come. That's another thing to consider.
Now, Paul, are you a fan of these TV matches? You've got the Tom Brady, Peyton Manning with Phil and Tiger. And then you've got the TaylorMade match where they are, you know, there's a lot of charity money being driven, which is great. And the TaylorMade match with Rory and DJ versus Ricky and Matt Wolf. Are you a fan of these? And from what I understand, they're going to play without caddies. At least Rory and DJ are. They're supposedly going to tote their own bags. Are you a fan of these?
I think it's a great way to start. You know, you got to start somewhere. And I think every sport really – you guys know this, baseball or football or basketball, hockey, they all, if they want to raise money for charity, they have a golf tournament. Well, golfers have golf tournaments too to raise money for charity. And, you know, you hear all the time about conditions and how bad they are. And then the average guy would say, well, gosh, I'd go play on an airport runway if they cut a hole in it for that kind of money, or I'd go play in a ditch. Well, these guys would go anywhere to try to raise money for this cause. But fortunately for them, they landed at Seminole, which is no ditch, as we know. It is revered and respected, actually just a spectacular place. You know, I heard also today, it's quite possible that that Palm Beach County is only going to give them the 20-minute warm-up time that's been allowed for public courses. Seminole's not a public place, but it's still they're going to have to go by the same guidelines, 20-minute warm-up, and then off they go for this made-for-TV event. I wonder at what point they'll get nervous and realize, oh, my gosh, there could be a lot of people watching this. At some point, it'll hit them. Sometimes, you know, it's not often you play golf when you realize that this is really made for TV. The first time that hit me was in 1988 at the PGA Championship, and I was leading the tournament, and it was the third round, last group on Saturday. And they went to introduce me, and they counted down to the cameraman, 10, 9, 8, and it went down to about 3, and he goes, hold on, wait, they're doing one more commercial. And I'm on the first tee, last group, leading the PGA, and it hit me that we had to wait another 30 seconds or a minute. This is made for TV. We're entertainers here in some respect. And it actually took a little pressure off me because that put me in kind of a show off mode, even though I didn't win. This is badass. I'm going to get playing. Let's get after it. So when it really struck me was 1988. It's going to hit these guys eventually, that camera staring in their face. I don't think Matt Wolf's used to it, but the other three are pretty used to it. It'd be cool. Right.
Are you a fan of playing a Ryder Cup without fans? Because that's been the talk. The talk is we could possibly have a Ryder Cup and not have fans. Isn't that what a Ryder Cup is?
Oh, yeah. It won't happen without fans. I don't even know if the network wants to do that without fans. I remember, I just heard Padraic say that we might have to take one for the team and go with no fans. I'm like, all right, sure, Padraic. I'm sure you'd love to go to Europe and play with no European fans over there. There's no way that the U.S. team is going to play with no fans. I just feel like that we delayed it at 9/11. We should delay it again, get it back on the odd number of years, and let the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup flip-flop. That just – I haven't talked to anybody. I haven't talked to Seth Waugh or the commissioner about it, but it just seems to make the most sense. Ryder Cup with no fans defeats the purpose.
Well, we're gonna get to some Ryder Cup questions, but I kind of wanted to start at the beginning of your career, Paul, and you know, a lot of people see the tour today, the glamour, the glitz, private jets, all of that. I mean, we even see in college programs where they're flying privately. And when you first started, you started in an RV in the early 80s, driving around the country. I mean, what was that like compared to what today's tour is like?
It's easier to get started if you get there. It's harder to get to the tour now, I think, than it ever has been. There's so many players trying to make it on tour. Now you can get your web card. You have to get your web card first. It's just harder to get on tour. But if you do make it, you generally have sponsors lined up and you're pretty flush and you can fly probably first class or coach, depending on the size of your travel crew, family, what have you. But when we did it, now I had 9 guys give me $3,000 a piece. And I got in my parents' like 1979 Cadillac or something. It was about football field long. And me and my buddy from my golf team in high school, Tom Janis, he ended up caddying for a bunch of good players. He won with Curtis Strain. He won with a bunch of players. But Tom Janis and I drove all the way out to Phoenix. It took us 3 days. It snowed when we were in Houston. My credit card ran out of money when I got to – I didn't even make it to Phoenix before my credit card ran out of money. I think the limit on the credit card was $50 or $100 at the time. I don't know what my parents were thinking. And it was just different. After a few months, my wife finished college and graduated, and we traded that car in and got a 24-foot mini motorhome where you drive like a truck and you sleep over top. And it was awesome. I mean, we saw the whole United States, and it was really a great time. I remember going through a toll booth one time where the motorhome didn't fit. You know, we weren't supposed to be in that booth, and my wife, she drove it. She ripped the whole awning off the side of the thing. Another time in New Jersey somewhere, I got on an interstate somewhere. No motorhomes allowed, and I literally had to go backwards down the interstate to get out of there because the thing wouldn't fit through the toll. We had all kinds of great stories. We had a cat. We had a cat in the motorhome. I remember the mini tours in Orlando. I would cook, you know, fish I'd catch out of the lakes. No wonder I got cancer in my shoulder when I was 93. We used to catch fish in the legs and cook them. And me and Black Mar'd be eating them with the wife. It was just a great time back then. Mini tours were really good back then because the money was good. You could win a three-day event and win $6,000 in 1983. A two-day event was $5,500. $5,500 for a two-day event. The J.C. Goosey Mini Tour. J.C. Goosey played the tour a long time ago, and it was a good player. But, yeah, the money was big. Now, I mean, Mini Tour events, $1,000 for first place. It's ridiculous. It's terrible. I feel for those guys. So, yeah, the Mini Tour, the motorhome life was great. And then once we got out of that, you know, Brian, I started making a little money and kept my car and got in the majors. You know, I saw one of your questions, too. It was going to be about 1987 British Open. I had a crack at winning that, obviously, and let that thing slip through my fingertips. And that was still motorhome days. But once I started playing like that, it was time to get out of the motorhome. So it was fun, though.
How do you look back at that 87 Open now? You know, you certainly had a different viewpoint of it in the aftermath, and probably that was actually right at the beginning of a really great run for you when you won, I think, 11 mm-hmm. times from 87 to 93. You know, but two bogeys on the last two holes, and of course you win the PGA in 93, so you do get a major. How do you view that now, I guess, compared to, you know, 30 years ago?
Well, I was heartbroken. I mean, I cried after that. It really crushed me. And, you know, you recover from it or you never recover from it. You either learn from it or never recover from it. And I tried to learn from it. And I, now that I look back, you know, I've been forced to call the Open Championship with ESPN and ABC for all these years. And I sat by Fowler doing it for a while. And he's the one that I kind of gave it to very much. He was in the right spot. So that was hard for me, but, you know, I think we grow people. We swallow your pride. I love hearing these guys nowadays when the pressure gets amped up. And it's like a race to see who can pretend to be the most comfortable or have it mean the least. Well, at the end of the day, I've still got this and that. Let me tell you something. 30 years later, I still think about the British Open. So you may have your safe room and you may, you know, at the end of the day, still have your money and your riches and all that stuff. But I can tell you what, a player is invested with his heart, soul, and mind in these golf tournaments and in this game. And when you lose, you may be okay at the end of the day, but it hurts, buddy. And it lasts. And that's part of the thrill of sport, you know, and the agony of defeat, isn't it? But the agony of defeat's real. I've had thrilling moments that have offset that British Open, but if that was the last thing that had ever happened to me, that would have been terrible.
Paul, you know, a lot of guys or a lot of people watching on television don't realize how difficult it is, the pressure that they're under. There's a huge difference in a guy standing on the first tee box on Thursday than there is a guy that's standing with the lead to hit an approach into the 72nd hole on Sunday. Have you seen guys, whether it be when you were playing or now that you've been doing commentating for so many years, have you seen guys that do they things change? They change their pre-shot routine or, and I hate to use the CH word, but have you seen guys choke? Have you seen just things change? And you know from being in that position before what it feels like to not do what you normally do.
Yeah, 100%. You've seen guys change. I've changed personally. You know, sometimes it's a simple choking to me is in your mind. Not generally in your fingertips, you know, or in your hands. I don't think good players at this point in their life, I don't believe their hands shake, but they didn't get to this point. Mm-hmm. You might get in a situation that you get this adrenaline boost and all of a sudden you realize your hands are in a quiver. But, I mean, you're so prepared to do this, but at the same time, you know, the pressure and the significance of what you're trying to accomplish can overwhelm you, I'm sure. And you go through exercises and techniques. These guys all have techniques how to control their heart rate and slow down their breathing. You know, this stuff's been around a while. The East Germans were the first really to get into it. Progressive relaxation is something these guys get into but don't talk about much. And I don't know if you've seen it or not, but, you know, the stuff that Rory's doing, these planks where he's elbows to push up, elbow to push up and all that stuff, is making these guys fit to where they think it's going to make them better. You know, I don't know how that makes you make a 5-footer, but if you think being that fit makes you better, then it does make you better, and it helps prevent you from choking. You know, the way to prevent all that choking thing is to be fully prepared to talk yourself through it. It's kind of like choking to go to the dentist a little bit. I mean, I hate the dentist, but I've gotten to where mentally I can get in there and literally just play golf in my head or go to another place. Of course, I always tell the dentist, no matter what you see in there, just say, oh, this will be a piece of cake. So once he's got that set, it's a mind trick. And I don't think choking is physical. Sometimes, like I remember a couple times having a chance to win the Players, and on Sunday, I couldn't see the line. I couldn't make a putt. I lost my feel, you know. Like if you were lawn bowling, you had that nice heavy ball and you could roll a 50-footer and roll it along the hills and all that. It seemed like it'd be pretty much a challenge to roll it up there really close. But you add a stick, an apparatus to that equation of lag and speed and then some pressure, and it does change. And sometimes I think when I lost the line that I was choking, because I was hard on myself when I missed putts. And I always felt I was choking when I missed putts. That's just how I felt. You never say it or admit it because you don't want anyone, you know, you don't want anyone to hear you ever think that about yourself. Right. But it's in there. They're human. They're all lying about how they feel generally. I mean, they don't tell the truth about what's really going on. They battle what's going on. They're in the mental battle. And until you get to be about my age, probably 60, you start fessing up what this was all about.
Is there any truth to getting over the hump, like that first win, once you experience or you learn how to win that first time? And then that had been said about Tiger after he had gone through the long time of not winning. And then it was, if he can just win that one time again, and then he won, you know, in Atlanta at the Tour Championship. And then he was able to get that major at the Masters in Augusta. Is there truth to once you get that one, it's easier to do it again because you know how to do it and you know what it feels like?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, you know, and what it ends up coming down to is self-belief and confidence. And, you know, Tiger, for him, he didn't really have to get over a hump. He had to just kind of, you know, see if he could just do it again. I didn't know for sure if he could do it again. I'm one of those guys that never poo-pooed Tiger's chances. I felt if he replaced his knee, he could still do it. But, you know, he surprises us all the time. But for a rookie or somebody like, let's say, Matt Wolf, he's in this skins game. He's a tremendous player. He already came right out of the gate and won. And, you know, is he going to be as – he's being compared to Colin Morikawa. He's being compared to the Victor Hovland. And, you know, is getting over the hump winning your second time, proving that the first one wasn't a fluke? Because that's what I went through. I remember winning once, and was it a fluke? And I'm like, well, I thought I got over the hump. I won. But you got to do it twice to prove that you, you know. So you're really, you know, it's weird. You can get over the hump in your own mind and then just let everybody think what they want about you.
Right.
But self-belief, those guys get self-belief and they can go off the chart.
You mentioned, you know, pressure in the mental end of it. And there's probably no greater pressure cooker really in golf than the Ryder Cup. And you've been a part of a few of those, both as a player and a captain, obviously. What were those? I guess I would ask you, how would you describe, particularly go back to 89 and 91? Obviously, everyone knows backstory. There's a lot of tension there, a lot of rivalry between you and Seve, the Europeans and the Americans. It tied in 89. You guys win at Kiowa in 91 in the War by the Shore with tremendous you know, pressure on Longer and everybody else associated with that. How do you view those Ryder Cups now, looking back, you know, again, 30 years later?
I'm a lot more mellow about it, you know, the competitive nature.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was back in about 87, 85, and then 87. I would have made the team in 87, but I had not attended the sweater folding class or whatever it was that the PGA of America required at the time. So I missed the 87 team, but it was 87 that the Ryder Cup became something that I really cared about, not knowing much about it, to be honest. But watching Jose celebrate on 18 with that dance, I was thinking, man, I wish I could move like that. And then I was like, he's rubbing our nose in it. And there was a bunch of us that didn't understand what the Ryder Cup meant to them. And it was like me and Calc and Freddie and Ken Green and John Cook and guys like Chip Beck. We all took it personal. And then we were the guys that got kind of on this next Ryder Cup team at Kiowa. Steve Pate, Corey Pavin. We took that whole thing personal, and that patriotism really kicked in. Well, they already had you know, the Ryder Cup's in their blood. You know, it's in our head. We want to win it, but it's in their blood, buddy. Believe me, you know that. You've been there, Brian. You know what that energy's like. It's something to behold over there, especially in Europe. And then they elevate to try to beat the juggernaut Americans. But it is, it's a great event. It is a pressure cooker. And, but you know, once you get through a Ryder Cup, I always felt like Ryder Cups came before majors for guys. You know, it's hard to say that about Australians and South Africans, but for most players, they'll play a Ryder Cup before they win a major championship. It very rarely goes the other way, but it does on occasion. It's something to notice, but it's awesome. We had Raymond Floyd in 1989. He put a lot of pressure on us. He introduced us as the 12 best players in the world. And then he just looked at every one of us, and we stood up for a second. I was first, I think, Azinger, Beck, and Kalkovecchia. And we stood up, and they were kind of booing in this big gala dinner that he had introduced us as the 12 best players in the world. He'd taken that line from Hogan, I think, from years earlier in a Ryder Cup, when he just, after the European captain had introduced all his players, he just said, ladies and gentlemen, the 12 best players in the world. And he stood up and sat down. Raymond used it. And it wasn't quite as true. So Tony Jacklin's response was, well, I guess that makes Seve number 13. And it was on then, buddy. And we had a hell of a match. And it came down to the wire. And somehow we ended up tying, which was a loss for us because they retained the cup. But by the time 91 rolled around, we were ready for action. And we took it personal. And it got ugly at times. And it was awesome now that I look back. But at the time, you know, if I look at myself then and now, it's like a completely different person.
Yeah. Wow. And then you know, of course you go to 2008, speaking of the 12 best players in the world, you're the captain. Europe had won 5 of the last 6, I think, Ryder Cups. You know, you come in there, there's a lot of expectation. You've got the pod system. It ends up working out. You have an unbelievable team. Of course, you know, Anthony Kim, part of that team. Which we'll get to, but what was it like, I guess, being captain in that position and you know, basically having to win?
Yeah, it was a weird, you know, I mean, it was a pressure-packed time. I mean, it was weird for me because I was actually promised to be the captain in 06 when it should have been Payne, but it ended up being Tom Lehman, and I didn't want to do it overseas. I wanted to do it in America, and so I waited, and then – so I figured I'd get it in 08. Well, I ended up having to lobby for it. But I had a concept that I lobbied with. I didn't just lobby, hey, I'm Paul Azinger, I played good at the Ryder Cup and won the PGA, I should be the captain. I lobbied with a concept. Roger Warren was the president of PGA, a former basketball coach. And I lobbied with this Navy SEALs concept of team building where you take that large group and break them into small groups. And I wanted to take 12 and break them into 3 groups of 4. And then sell them out within their groups and get them to sold out for each other and the whole nine yards. He loved it. So being a basketball coach, he knew what that was all about. Team building was my whole goal. And I took this outside the box approach. But if you can sit, you think about what our players go through at Ryder Cup and the thrashings that they've taken, they've gotten to where they dread the Ryder Cup, Brian. And I was in a position as a captain to have to deal with Tiger and Phil. Tiger didn't get on our team because of his knee, blew his leg out or whatever, his broken bone there. But, you know, I had to deal with guys like Mickelson and Furyk, guys who got it handed to them over and over again. And you know what? This concept of team building really got them intrigued and engaged, and it changed the way they felt about this Ryder Cup. And our Ryder Cup was these guys were in their small groups, not based on light games or anything to do with golf, but based on business principles that are used in corporate America, the Myers-Briggs. We use Myers-Briggs, caution light, green light, red light personality types. We tried to find all the green light personality types based on 4 personality types. And it was just worked. We got green lights together, and I just let them do their thing and pretty much stayed out of the way. And they bonded in their small groups. They sold out for each other. Actually, had 9 players. I picked Stricker. I got 4 picks instead of 2. I wanted 4 picks. And I picked Stricker, which gave me 9 players, 3 three-man teams. I ended up calling every player on each little pod. I remember calling Mickelson, Justin Leonard, Anthony Kim, and saying, hey, you 3 guys are a pod, but I'm going to give you a chance to pick 1 more player to fill out your group. I got 6 names that didn't make the team. I see it are green light personalities for your pod. You three guys get together and decide which one of those six you want. If you choose outside the six names I give you, I'll explain to you why you're wrong. And so they all called each other, and about an hour later, Mickelson called me and said, we want Hunter Mahan. I said, oh, I'll give you Hunter Mahan. So I called Hunter and then sold him on the whole process. These guys would have run through a wall for each other. This is the most bonded Ryder Cup team ever, by far. And that's how we did it. And they just went out and performed their asses off because nobody wanted to let anybody else down. And Furyk came out with my favorite line of the whole thing. He said, it's the first Ryder Cup I ever went to. He said, it was the first time that I wasn't so obsessed with my game, but how I could make the players around me better. And I was like, wow, how good is that?
What do you think of when you look at today's Ryder Cup from the standpoint of, you know, it was a much different environment back in 89 and 91. Europeans lived in Europe. There was much more of there's less of a camaraderie between guys. Now, a lot of international guys, Americans all live in Florida. They know each other. Most of them play the PGA Tour. Do you think it's different now than it was even go back to 08? Is it different than 08 in terms of that dynamic?
I think social media changed it. We didn't congratulate each other to the whole world. Sometimes I didn't like a guy, I wasn't even that interested in saying congratulations. That's how we were.
Okay.
So different back then. You'd get jealous of a guy that was beating your brains out. Now they congratulate each other. So it is a different dynamic. I think it's much more difficult to be a good player today. I really feel for a guy like Rory McIlroy, if he lets a tournament get away and he deals in social media, then all the, anybody with two thumbs can take a shot at you. And imagine what Poulter must hear and go through. When Dustin Johnson lost the U.S. Open, all the people that called him a choker, probably none of them texted him congratulations when the very next year he came back and won the U.S. Open, which I think is one of the greatest wins in all of sports that is never even considered as such. Imagine losing the U.S. Open the way he lost it and then coming back and winning the next year at Oakmont. And a great story I heard about that was his brother Austin went in there early to go check out Oakmont. And he looked at the whole course. I don't know if he played it or just walked here or whatever, but he walked into the pro shop. And he wanted somebody in the pro shop asked him if he needed something like another yardage book or a greens book or whatever. He goes, nah, you know what? He says, I'm not going to worry about it. He says, Dustin's got no chance here anyway. So I'll just get it when I get here. And he ended up winning the golf tournament. So it's a funny story around Oakmont.
And the way he won with the penalty that they told him to, they talked to him in the middle, then he had to play out. I mean, everything about that was really, truly unbelievable.
Yeah, it was. That was a dramatic time. That was my first year with Fox, actually, I think. And, it was a real eye-opener that, that type of a snafu and this type of – in this time when he has a ruling like that. And then with the social media crying out, and we were seeing that while we were in the booth and realizing that the players didn't know that there might be a penalty. Would they play differently? And that whole thing got so complicated. But I felt like as a network, for a first-time effort for us, they were at Chambers Bay the year before, but for a first-time effort for Fox, we were all over that. And we couldn't, pussyfoot around that kowtow to the USGA in that situation. Right. We had to be candid and we had to be reporters or we'd gotten shredded. So I thought journalistically we handled that pretty well.
Before I get to, I want to ask you a couple questions about Tiger Woods. Are you a fan of fans being able to call penalties in and saying, hey, I saw this or I saw that? Are you okay with that? Or do you think that's it? Because we don't do that in any other sport.
It's complicated in golf, though, because they call penalties on themselves. So, yeah, I would say if there's an infraction, it should be brought to the attention of the ruling bodies before the conclusion of the event. After the conclusion, that's it. But if you do something on Thursday that you was a mistake, usually, 99.9% of the time, it's totally unintentional. But if you did it on a Thursday, I always felt like it was fair to get DQ'd on a Sunday for something you did on a Thursday. I just thought, wow, you don't want to have everybody know that you made a mistake. And then you got, you know, you got the benefit of the doubt, or you should be two shots higher, but because you already signed your card. Now I believe they changed the rules. I think I don't want to speak to exactly what they are, but I just feel like now you can make a mistake, certain mistakes, and they'll just change your scorecard for you. So right. It's different. It's a lot easier.
Right. Speaking of Tiger, and I know that you've played with Tiger and you've seen a lot of Tiger Woods, and I'm sure you've been asked 100 times what's your favorite Tiger Woods story, and I'm sure you've got 100. But what's the most impressive thing about Tiger Woods to you? Because as a fan, I mean, there's a lot of things about him that impress me, but as somebody who's played the game and been in the situations and probably stood next to him on the same tee box at the same putting green and seen some shots that you're like, well, how the hell did he pull that off? Like, what's the most impressive thing about him to you?
I've seen all this. I mean, so many shots. The way he hits a long iron is like you've never seen anybody do that before or since. And there's been some guys that can hit some nice long irons. Jack hit great long irons. Weisskopf could hit great long irons. Greg Norman hit beautiful long irons, but nothing like what Tiger could do. And he could do it out of a fairway bunker. But I think overall, the thing about Tiger that I just don't know that anyone of us could have ever imagined was sustainability, the repeatability, that he could win once and not have a letdown and then win again the next week and not have a letdown, you know, or take 2 weeks off and then come back out and win again and not have a letdown. You know, it's a mountaintop experience to win a golf tournament. And he just got so used to it. But another thing, too, about this guy, the fact that he had that repeatability and that sustainability goes down to his ball striking, his putter, and the way he hit his short irons. He drove it nice. They act like he drove it wild, but he didn't. He drove it clutch. But if you listen to him hit short irons, short clubs, that's the scoring club. That's where you butter your bread, that short club and on the greens. And that's where Tiger Woods did all his damage. If you consider, if you think about all his great memories, they aren't off the tee. All his dramatic moments are on and around the greens, and or he hits hole out wedges or something like he did at Pebble Beach. And I remember hitting balls next to him one time at Muirfield Village. I was with my caddy. I wasn't swinging great or anything, and he was only a few years old. He won the Masters. I think it was a couple years after he won the Masters. And I, you know, we got down to where we could hit into the wind, and we were both hitting nine irons. And I just was hearing something over there I'd never heard before. And when I watched the ball leave, it looked like the ball was attached to a string, and it up at the end was a kite. And once it got up to the top, you know how you get that soft kind of line that goes on the kite line? That's what his flight looked like. And it came down like a butterfly with sore feet. And I just knew I couldn't do that. And I looked at my caddy and I said, I got to tell you the truth. This is hurting my confidence. We need to get out of here. And we scooped up all my stuff and moved on because I didn't want to hear any more of that. That he was on another level.
That's unbelievable.
Paul, it just was. It took a minute to impress me now. I promise you that.
Right,
I'm like,
exactly.
Really, show me. And he did.
But you knew that was something different. We've got a quick thing we do here. It's called a quick nine. Before we let you go, let's get a quick nine holes in real quick. So we'll ask you nine quick, easy questions. And I'm going to let Wacker start off. So Wacker, you go first.
Here we go. One last round. Where are you playing? What course?
Oh, gosh. Last round of my life, I'm going to play a golf course built in 1926. It's in my hometown at Bradenton Country Club, built by Donald Ross. Come see it if you get a chance. Come see it if you get a chance.
Hole number two, what three players complete Paul Azinger's ultimate foursome?
Well, if I'm going to go with the greatest players that I never saw, I would love to see Bobby Jones. I would love to see Hogan, and I would love to see what Byron Nelson did. I've got a good dose of what Trevino could do and Weisskopf, and I saw Snead hit balls, Mo Norman hit balls, the Golden Bear, and right up next to Tiger. But give me those three. I'd like to see what they had.
Wow.
All right, your life is on the line. Who are you picking to win this matchup, Rory or Brooks?
I got to go Rory. I'm going to take talent over just full up guts. I never seen anything quite like Rory McIlroy either, you know, now, not since Tiger. It was really for us, we caught Watson in the 80s, and we caught, after Watson, Norman. And that was pretty nice. That was a sight to behold. And then, you know, maybe some Faldo and Nick Price mixed in there. But when Tiger showed up, I was like, oh. Well, Rory's like that to me. I stand there and watch Rory. That's why I'm hard on him when he doesn't win, because I just don't know how he doesn't win. So I just think Rory's going to beat him. And he'll, you know, my man went to Florida State too. Brooks went to Florida State. He'll trash me for that. But I just think Rory's outstanding.
All right, fourth hole. You're stuck on a deserted island, and you got one PGA Tour player to play with. Who is it?
Oh, I'm going to play with Stadler, because he's going to throw a club on the first hole if he doesn't like it, and he's never going to blame anybody but himself. That's I love playing with that guy. Watch every shot. I'm playing with Stadler.
All right, here we go. We saw recently, we heard this story, of course, Brooks telling a story about how he trash-talked Michael Jordan when the two were playing golf together. Jordan comes back, of course, wins the last two holes to win the match. We all know trash-talk golfers are not good trash-talkers, but who's the better or the best trash-talker, Tiger or the field?
The field. The field. Now, Tiger's got GOAT status, so he can but there's so many guys out there that can trash talk. You have no idea. I remember I was paired with BJ saying the final group at Jack's tournament at Muirfield Village on a Sunday or a Saturday, I guess. And anyway, I looked at him. I called him Show Pony. He called me Show Pony because we were playing good back then, and we were winning Placer Show every week. So we called each other Show Pony. So I said, I looked at BJ on the first tee. I said, hey, man, last group. So good luck today, bud. He looks at me, he goes, Zingy, I'm going to kick your ass today. I said, is that right? I said, let me tell you something, Show Pony. All you're going to see around my buddy is a big cloud of dust and you're going to be trapped in it. And that's how we talked to each other when we played back then. I'm not kidding you. Guys would snap off a trash talk right on the first tee. Keep up if you can. Payne would trash talk. I snapped off some stuff on Payne. Hey, Payne, if I get going bad today, I used to do this. I'd do this. Hey, Payne. If I get playing bad today, now don't you worry about me, all right? You just mind your own business, keep your own, you know, like I was a good guy. But really deep down inside, I just wanted to think I was a better guy than I really was. I really wanted to know I was fixing to rip his heart out, but I wanted to think if I play bad, don't worry about it. So, but Payne, I said that one time to Payne, he just looked at me, he just laughed at me. He just said, I don't care about what you do today. And I believed him. And so off we went. But we trash talked on the first tee a little bit. It's
number
fun.
Six. I know you.
Sorry, I'm taking so long.
I know you've had dinner with Wacker before, so that's right. One dinner guest. So if you had to have
dinner, told me that BJ story, by the way, over dinner. It was great. Yeah.
So if you had to have dinner with either Wacker again or Patrick Reed, who you choosing?
Oh, Patrick Reed by a mile. Patrick Reed, I love Patrick Reed. You know, I don't know if I've been too hard on him or giving him the benefit of the doubt, but. Sometimes I wonder what goes through his head, but he's actually, when you get up close to him and if you can get in that veneer, you know, that he's got a bad reputation. He can't make any more mistakes, but I kind of root for him. I love his swing. Love the way he plays the game.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of guys to love, that 2008 Ryder Cup team, you had Boo Weekly and Anthony Kim on the team. Who was more fun at the after party?
Oh, my God. They tied. They absolutely tied. When AK got – he set up shots for everybody. 24 shots, wives, players, assistants, 29 shots, however many shots there was. And we all had to do shots with AK. Then the European team came up, you know, because that's a tradition. But Boo was good. Westwood came up to the room, and he was hammered. And we had this long wall full of memorabilia. And guys, you know, we had to sign all the memorabilia. And Westwood had slipped over there to our memorabilia and started putting his name on it. And Boo had approached him, and hey, he gave him a tap on the shoulder. He says, hey, that's our stuff. You need to get out of here, you know. I see you over here again. I'm gonna whoop your ass. And so Westwood moseyed on out. And then a couple minutes later, Westwood, he's pretty hammered. He sneaks over there, and he's kind of chuckling. He's signing our stuff. So Boo goes over there, and it was like, uh-oh, is this going to get ugly? Because you don't know. Is Boo going to fix him to snap off a pata? But Boot got on a chair and he whistled and shut the whole room down. He goes, anybody want to sign anything in here? And he just pulled his shirt up with that big old Boo belly and he just signed it right here. And it just brought the house down. He also told us the orangutan story that week when he got in a ring with an orangutan, which is just brilliant stuff. Got knocked out by an orangutan. Mm-hmm. You've never heard him tell it. Those two were the team leaders, really. Boo Weekly and AK was the youngest player on the team. He just wanted to beat Sergio. That's all he cared about. And then he drew Sergio in singles.
Mm. Wow. That's awesome.
That's cool.
PGA, former PGA Tour commissioner, current PGA Tour commissioner, Fincham Monahan. Who wins that match?
Hey, look, they're both going to be great. I mean, I feel for Monahan now what he's got to deal with, but I believe he can handle it. I hope.
We're talking about them playing golf, Paul.
Yeah.
Commissioner-wise or golf-wise?
Golf-wise. Who wins
golf-wise,
the match?
Golf-wise. Who wins that match?
See how I was doing? I was all serious. I don't know. I've never seen any of them play. Fincham can't hit it more than 140 in the air. He's little. He's a little dude. He can't hit it that far. So I'm gonna give the nod to Monahan. I've never even seen him swing it. Far.
Fair enough.
He'd pound him.
Go ahead, Monahan.
And here we go. Speaking of guys who can't swing clubs, but they all love to do it. I remember this in college. When I played basketball, we'd get guys from other sports coming over wanting to play on the court. And you see it in golf all the time with we see Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and we see Tony Romo and, of course, Steph Curry. Who is the best guy from another sport that you've ever seen play golf?
Gosh, Johnny Bench was good. I know that. The worst I ever seen was Dr. J try to play golf.
Than Barkley?
You know, I'm going to give him a thumbs neutral on both of them. They're pretty much a tie, those two. But Barkley was a single digit one time in his life. And then somehow someone told him about trying to pause at the top, and that pausing at the top started about hip high on the way down, and it wrecked him. Wow. He'll never get over that, I don't think. I just have to say, you know who was really good was Jerry West. Played with Jerry West way back in the day in Portland at one of Peter Jacobson's events, and he was a phenomenal player.
Wow.
I mean, he's got a logo after him. I'm not surprised.
No kidding. He was amazing.
He did. Real quick, I want to ask you one more question, then I need a tip from you. One more. Have you watched any of the Tiger King?
No. And I think it was right here. We have a big cat habitat right here in Bradenton or Sarasota.
You do.
Yeah, I know those people are crazy.
Yeah, they're a little nutty. I'm playing tomorrow morning at TPC Sawgrass with Billy Horschel. You got any tips for me to help me get in his wallet or no?
Hey, anything you can do to beat Billy Horschel. You know, that whole thing when I jumped on that European tour comment was really meant to, you know, I mean, we're part charged with the task of trying to draw the viewer in a little bit and make some drama. But Billy's got to win in America. He knows that. And I've used some bad grammar. But the only American that really was hard on me about it was Horschel. But he was hard in a way that was kind of like walking away from me hard, like 44 wins, you disrespecting 44. You know, he's kind of like that too. So just go beat him. Just go beat him. I don't know. I don't know any good stories on him. I wish I – ask him if he's going to let Rory continue to pound him in that Peloton.
He really is pounding him on that. That Peloton's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I can't believe they can do that. Those guys are fit. Well, I tell you, it's different. You know, the guys ahead before us, 10, 20 years before us, were drinking vodka. And then maybe 10 years after them was vodka and orange juice. And then my guys, we started drinking orange juice. Now these guys are on protein drinks and doing this kind of stuff, planking and all that. It's a whole nother level of speed and power. And I love it. I just read where Faldo said eliminate the tee box. And I'm like, man, that's just so wrong. Let those guys hit that ball 10 seconds in the air and let's see where that thing ends up. I love it. Let them just blast away. You can hide any pin from a player.
Right. Paul, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate it and enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Appreciate it, man. Stay safe, and we will see you back out on the tour once it gets started.
I'm getting started in a few days. I'm going to get my COVID test. They're coming to the house to test me for the COVID before I go do the tournament.
Nice.
We're going to St. Augustine at the tour headquarters to cover the tournament in Jupiter I wonder if I'm going to do tournaments from my house someday. They just set me up a setup like this. Why not?
Yeah, you could. You really could. If that's the safest thing to do to keep you safe and keep others safe.
If that's the way we're going to live, you know. That country song, I'd rather live while I'm dying than die while I'm living.
Exactly. Ain't that the truth? You said it earlier. Quarantining well people is not easy.
You can't quarantine healthy people, can you? I guess so. They did it.
We've done it for 6 weeks.
They're starting to get antsy.
Yeah.
And I think, honest to God, I think, you know, the starting too early is better than starting too late. Because if it's too late, it's too late.
Right.
You know, too late's too late.
It
better
is.
Better to start early.
Appreciate it, Paul. Have a good one, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Anytime.
See you later, man. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See you, Brian. All right. See you guys.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who will be selected number one? Which teams will trade up and down? And who will be crowned Mr. Irrelevant? It's time for the 2024 NFL Draft. And iHeart is your home for the NFL Podcast Network. Get all the insights, mock drafts, and trade rumors with podcasts like Around the NFL and Move the Sticks. Open the free iHeart app and search NFL Draft for dozens of podcasts, playlists, and live stations to get you ready for the weekend's big event.
Let's go!
Listen to NFL podcasts on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search NFL to start listening.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.